Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 50. On this monumental and historic episode of the show, we are going to talk about a movie that is equally historic and monumental, and that is Selma. For this episode, it's really great because I got to team up with J.R. Forresteros, Clay Morgan, two of the story men. So if you're familiar with their podcast, you know they're going to bring a lot to the table. And we get to reunite with a new friend that we made at the Baylor Faith and Film Symposium from the Sideshow Media Group, John Booker. So we have a great conversation because this movie is loaded with things to talk about. We have the historical significance of Selma itself. We have some of the criticism from the historical problems or perceived problems of the film. We have the importance of needing to know our history and the lessons we get from that. And in this particular case, we also look at Martin Luther King Jr. himself and how he is a very, very compelling Christian role model. So with that said, we want to really encourage you, if you haven't, to go see this movie because it is really important. Hopefully you'll enjoy it as much as we did, and hopefully you'll have lots to think about. So here it is, episode 50, Selma and History's Lessons. Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless.
No, it is a very odd and weird thing to cheer on a sniper, you know, someone who is literally, you know, in the business of taking human lives. That's a hard thing for me to get around, especially, and I think you sent us an article to look at on this, especially in the light of, you know, the film's embrace by evangelical Christians is this guy being a person of faith, and the non-embrace of Selma, you know, when Martin Luther King Jr., I think, is a lot better person for us to aspire to be as people of faith, you know, as opposed to the guy in American Sniper. But, you know, I'm sure we can get into that in the podcast.
Yeah, well, I mean, Selma certainly seems like it's, almost every review that I've read has been like, it's an important film, it's historic, it's a landmark film, like people need to see it. And it doesn't seem like people are seeing it. And I wonder if it's just because they don't understand the importance of some of these events, or if they don't care.
Well, and it's just an interesting thing as well that aside from your rare exceptions like Will Smith, the majority of white people don't go and see what they perceive to be black movies. And I think that plays into it quite a bit, is people see it and say, oh, that's for black people. That's a black movie.
Yeah.
And so they don't go see it.
I don't disagree with you at all, John. But, like, it's crazy to me that people consider Selma a black movie, because to me, I'm just like, this is like a pivotal moment in American history.
Yeah.
That's within living memory of a lot of people. Not me.
Absolutely.
Not us, but it's America. It's an American. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
It bothers me that so many more people.
This should be the podcast.
It is the podcast.
It bothers me that so many more people are like, oh my gosh, American Sniper should win all the awards. It's the most amazing movie ever movied in the history
of movies.
To be honest with you, if we're trying to stack, you know, what films are most deserving, I would stack The Theory of Everything far ahead of American Sniper. I thought that was an amazing film, and I was much more taken by those performances and that story even than I was American Sniper. It is interesting because of a lot of the, shall we say, historical problems with the theory of everything, that nobody really had any problems with that film the way they have Selma.
Yeah.
But again, I don't know if we're like into the podcast yet, but I feel like that's something good to talk about in the podcast.
Well, I wanted to mention that because I kind of wanted Clay to set the stage for us with kind of the importance of Selma, because I definitely do want to talk about some of the controversy that has surrounded Selma about the historical inaccuracies and how important or not important those things are for this being a supposedly, and for most, you know, for all intents and purposes, a historical film, you know, so why is this movie so important, Clay? Why is Selma so important?
Hold on. If I'm going to be the history expert, let me Wikipedia this.
Uh-oh.
Oh, okay. Okay. I guess I should have known. Well, to put it in context, the Civil War ended in 1865, and that's when slavery was abolished. 100 years later, in 1965, there were still a handful of Southern states using a number of different, well, they were called at different times, you know, Jim Crow laws, black codes, that were used to keep true equality from coming to the voting rolls of these Southern states. So you had certain areas like Birmingham, Alabama, where 99% of the town's voting rolls mm-hmm. were white, even though the population was largely skewed in the other direction. And I thought the film, by the way, did a good job. You know, they used Oprah as her name's escaping me, Alice Lee Cooper, mm-hmm. To kind of demonstrate what it would be like for one individual to face that kind of systemic and individualized racism at the voting poll. And then they later on had a scene where they're in the room and they're kind of trying to figure out which legislative tactic should we take, which one of these laws should we take on first. So the actual restriction of African Americans from even being able to exercise the vote that was constitutionally provided 100 years earlier is the first thing that's at stake. And as far as the modern civil rights movement goes, that really kicks off at the end of World War II, when a million black men and women fight in World War against racism, right? America sends segregated troops to fight against the tyranny of racism. And when they returned, Ralph Ellison wrote a book called The Invisible Man, and he talked about how for as much racism as there was in America, there was also the reality. He said, I am just an invisible man. And the problem was that mainstream America, white America, just didn't even see very often the injustices. And that's an important point when we talk about Selma and the portrayal later on of LBJ, because there were a number of powerful American politicians who were just naive about how bad it really was. That includes Eisenhower, Kennedy, and LBJ for sure. So
are you trying to tell me that white people didn't understand how bad it was for non-white people? I'm skeptical.
That is the suggestion. And then Jackie Robinson comes along in 47. Baseball is high profile. That kicks things into higher gear. And by the mid-50s, you have the murder of Emmett Till in Mississippi. And after his murderers were acquitted in court, it wasn't but a couple months later that Rosa Parks and a couple other people started refusing to give their seats up on a bus. And when the Southern Christian Leadership Conference was coming together, it was churches that were, you know, these built-in flocks, and it was preachers in the South, most famously, of course, Martin Luther King Jr., who was able to step up, and he became the voice of the movement because he just was a prodigy as a speaker and a thinker. And the first time they asked him to make a few remarks at one of their meetings, well, everybody knew he was the guy. So then the bus boycotts and education, the segregation of education was targeted in the court system. And so by the time we get to the 60s, 1963, the I Have a Dream speech, you know, is this moment that is kind of memorialized. But then it was time to really push for the big legislative changes. And that's where Selma comes in. So 1964's legislation, Civil Rights Act, has passed. And now it's time to make sure that the voting rights is equal as well.
Okay, so this film is obviously trying to tackle something that is not just like important in American history, but monumental. But Absolutely. So what the film captures, I guess I want to know where you guys landed on this. Instead of asking you if you enjoyed the movie, which is what we typically kind of start the show with, I want to point out that this past year has been a year of tons of biopics. I mean, we have Unbroken. John mentioned earlier The Theory of Everything. We had The Imitation Game, Get Up, American Sniper, Wild, and depending on how you saw it, Exodus. So, I mean, how important is this film, in your opinion, to today's culture? And I don't know if you guys want to draw straws to go first, but...
I mean, John is the furthest away.
That is true.
Well, you know, it's really interesting because there's certainly a crop of people who would say that movies based on history or biopics have done better historically with the Academy, and that, you know, it's Oscar bait. I don't, you know, there's certainly in Hollywood a desire to have prestige and to win Oscars. But at the end of the day, they're trying to make money. Even to win Academy Awards, it's really about, you know, promoting the film to make money. So, you know, you have to say, well, how is dealing with history or dealing with biopics going to further the pocketbooks of the studios? Well, there's something powerful about knowing what we're seeing on screen actually happened. And even though we may see something that says based on a true story, or, you know, this is, these characters come from a true story, mm-hmm. I believe when people watch those types of films, they really don't separate and say, well, this is just based on a true story. We watch them as though this is how it really happened. And therefore, a lot of the concern and controversy comes out about these films, because I believe when most people watch them, you could know what happened historically, but what you see on screen is going to feel more real to you than what may have actually happened historically.
So you, when it comes to Selma, you think that the fact that this stuff actually happened and it was going to make it real was going to somehow equal dollars?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I think if we just told a story of anyone from that era that was, say, a fictionalized character from that era, I don't believe it would have the financial impact at the box office. But knowing that this is part of history, it's interesting, because I believe a lot of Americans now go to films to actually become educated about different things. And a lot of people who have seen the film, aside from people like Clay that actually knew, you know what happened, a lot of people who see the film now feel like whatever they have taken from the film is what they know about Selma or the civil rights era. And that's not in and of itself a completely bad thing. But I think, you know, that movie studios know that if there is a historical tie, it's going to draw more people into the box office. If it is based on real history, that's going to draw more people in. The problem comes in that, you know, whenever you're going to base something on real life events that really happened, rarely do real life events play out in a way that's going to fit typical Hollywood three-act structure that allows us to put it in a condensed Hollywood film the way that people are used to having films packaged to them.
Mm-hmm. So the fact that this film, even though it's, you know, making more money than I'll ever see, it's far behind lots of the other biopics. Would you say that is because people are not interested in this topic? They're ashamed of this topic, or they're ignorant to this movie even exists, or it's just not a good movie compared to, like I said, Unbroken or The Theory of Everything. I mean, The Imitation Game, like all these movies are doing fairly well. And Selma is, I mean, floundering might be harsh, but it's definitely probably not having the impact that I would say they thought.
I would be interested to hear how JR sees this as someone who's dealing with, you know, people in his church every week, because I feel like a lot of people in American evangelical churches don't see this film as so much of a historical pick or even a church pick or a pick about a hero of the faith as much as they see this as a race pick, and maybe even seeing it as a reminder of where the particular race that many of them are had really veered off the course of what was moral and right.
Yeah, you know, I don't think that most evangelicals, particularly in the pews, regard Martin Luther King as a hero of the faith. He's viewed as a civil rights leader, as a race activist. Good, not in a bad way,
mm-hmm.
but when you consider that he was an exceptionally strong leader whose entire approach to civil rights was shaped by Jesus's ethic of nonviolence, and that he was a reverend, right? That he was a preacher first. You would think that he would have more clout and status in our churches, but he just doesn't. And I don't know if that's because evangelicalism is still predominantly white and race is highly problematic for evangelical churches. I'm sure that has to be part of it.
I was shocked when I went to a fairly conservative church in Pennsylvania, and they had a bookstore. It was a big enough church. They had a pretty nice bookstore. And I actually saw Strength of Love on the shelf in there. And I was like, what? This was like 4 or 5 years ago, yeah. at least. And that led me to read that book. And I'm like, if it's here, I mean, that I couldn't even get my book into that bookstore, you know, yeah. in my own church.
It's because you wrote about zombies.
Technicality. But,
you know, to answer your question, let me ask you, the first time or two that you saw the trailer, did you... I couldn't get my normal like history teacher excitement going because I'm thinking the current climate right now is so charged that the trailer was definitely presenting the showdown, and I bet it made a lot of people uncomfortable more than it might have in another time, another month even. But it's also not marketed to be comfortable for white people, right?
Yeah. Well, that's part of the thing. Actually, thinking about what's gone on in the country over the past year, racially, I felt like this film was probably going to maybe add to the noise, and I was a little worried about that. But honestly, as a person of faith, I am one of the people who look to Martin Luther King Jr. as a hero of the faith, not just a hero for like social equality. And my biggest concern was watching the previews and saying, I wonder if they're going to do what most everyone else does on, you know, Martin Luther King Jr.'s holiday, which is take his quotes out of context to push whatever, you know, general agenda that they have. And I was afraid I was not going to see enough of his faith spurring the action.
Pleasantly surprised then, right?
I was surprised, but I wasn't as surprised as I wanted to have been.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I saw him in churches. I saw him referencing God, but I don't know. That's why I'm wondering. I'm like, was my expectation, like, did I want this to be laid on so thick that no one could deny it? Or like,
I feel like it was so thick no one could deny it.
Huh.
That's just interesting because I was so pleased with the way they handled his faith in the film. Huh.
Yeah, I agree. I was pretty pleased as well. There were two significant scenes to me that were deeply moving about his faith. One is when he called Mahalia Jackson mm-hmm. late at night and wanted to feel like he was hearing from God. And I thought that was a really precious moment about his faith. And then the other, when he was in jail and he was talking to one of the other pastors, and he talked about his faith and his calling. And I thought it was just a very, very strong moment about his faith. And so those two scenes for me were significant.
Well, in the prison, then when he's discouraged, and by way of encouraging him, the other pastor just starts quoting scripture to him, but not in like a random trite way, but in this way where like literally the scriptures have formed the vocabulary of their resistance. you know, and I was staggered. And then, yeah, Clay just brought up, you know, that the scene on the bridge where he aborts the march, you know, and it's because he kneels down and pray, like he prays, you know, and it's like God, I thought it was, I took it pretty clear as God told him not to march.
Hmm.
And so he turned around and didn't.
Well, then I will allow that as evidence that I was not paying enough attention.
Just to return for a second back to, you know, what we were saying about how, you know, people of faith and how especially evangelical culture deals with King. I worked for a Christian nonprofit organization about 12 years ago, and I remember having a really significant conversation with one of the vice presidents. January rolled around, and I asked what he was going to do over the long holiday when you know, the MLK holiday rolled around, and he said, "Well, I'm certainly not going to celebrate, you know, King." And I said, "Well, that's curious." And this guy's an ordained pastor, and I said, what's your issue with King?" And he said, "Well, he was immoral. He had affairs, and so I just you know, I don't like him." And I was blown away. This guy who, you know, could preach about people like King David on the weekend, and mm-hmm. you know, other people who have had significant moral failures, he had no problem with, but for some reason, you know, he had a real issue with King. And, you know, while I think probably people under a certain age are never going to feel that way, I think there is a certain group of folks who really do feel, you know, very strongly, and whether that is based out of racism or whether that's based out of, you know, just the age that they are, who knows, but I know I've encountered that firsthand.
Huh.
It is interesting that comparison that you bring up, that because King had these aspects of his life that evangelicals don't embrace, even though we have all these other examples in the scriptures, that's a reason we can discount him. That's a really interesting insight.
Well, I think one of the things that's hardest is it seemed like they were trying to present King as a flawed man, but they didn't make it, well, I don't want to say they didn't present it at all, but they kept skirting the issue, and there kept being non-conversations about it. It's like they're not even sure what happened, so they didn't know how to tell the story of exactly what happened.
I was surprised that they even showed as much tension in the household as they did, but yeah, it's, you know, again, going back to the ideas of biopics and what do you show, these windows of time seem to be more effective in that regard than, like, I remember reading a review for Long Walk to Freedom when they made the Mandela movie, I think it was called.
Uh-huh.
And the writer in Entertainment Weekly was saying it's ineffective because they tried to pack his entire life into the movie. And I had never thought about how that's a decision you have to make when you're doing a movie about a person, you know, whereas even Spielberg did just like 3 months of Lincoln. And now I've like kind of been reevaluating every one of these kind of movies I've ever seen. And I was certainly thinking about that in Selma, that this isn't the Martin Luther King Jr. story, you know, ready made for an ABC two-night miniseries. And there's so much, though, right? This is like the climactic moment of the movement. This is the triumphant legislative achievement. So obviously some of those things have happened. And I remember leaving the theater, I watched it with JR, and I said, what was that all about with his wife? And were they really going there? Because I'm just, you know, I kind of expect that I'm going to get a little more hero sandwich than that.
Yeah.
And I kind of respected the fact that they were, I mean, King certainly didn't shy away from how unprepared he felt, from how overwhelmed he felt, from the multiple times he wanted to quit, and from being a failure as a man. So, you know, it wasn't just a let's make a movie to canonize the guy.
No, and I like that too, because I think I read a very similar review about the Mandela film, and then I started thinking about most of the biopics that I'd seen. And the ones that I'd liked more than the ones I hadn't. And I remember watching 40 and being like, this is pretty good.
42,
yeah. But I wanted it to kind of hone in a little more. And then, then I watched Get Up a little earlier this year. And I was like, wow, but this is like his whole life. And so they never stuck with anything long enough for me to really understand like the decisions he was making and the struggles that he was going through. It just was, you know, he feels like this now. 5 years later, he's like this kind of person. And that's how it was with, you know, the Mandela film. And this one definitely didn't do that because you had this in a small amount of time. And even then, I wish, obviously I can't make history shorter than it already is, but I almost wish it was even less time than they showed, because at times I had trouble understanding how long it was between what they were doing.
You sound like every student I ever had. You wanted to be shorter.
Well, I wanted there to be more, because I was like, well, what just happened for the past like 4 days? Like, how did he get back in Washington? How, like, when is this traveling happen? How long are they marching there? Like, I couldn't really get the sense of how long they were in this city or that city, or how long between, you know, marches that we were actually seeing, and how many other events happened. And I wanted it to kind of, I wanted to be there, because the movie did a really good job of, I felt, involving us in the struggle as opposed to telling us about the struggle. You know, especially picking up the one young black man who eventually was rioting at night, and they tried to escape into the cafe. And he was,
oh yeah, Jimmy Lee Jackson.
Yeah, Jimmy Lee Jackson. I mean that right there. I felt like I was in the night protest. I was running. I was scared. You know, I was a part of the movement at that point, from like the storytelling point of view. I wasn't just watching something. Did it not like capture anybody else? I mean, like, were you part of the story or?
I thought it was filmed great. I mean, definitely the most poignant, one of the most poignant moments in the movie was the scene between King and the grandfather as well. I mean, all of that. I was just really, man, the theater was just pin drop silent from the time they were chased through that moment.
I kind of felt you there, Mikey, that, you know, I was a little unsure on the chronology. But I also, like, I wonder if that's because it was a true story, if you were so caught up in the dates. I felt like the storyline was linear enough that I was able to follow everything.
Yeah, I understood what was going on. I just, for something that could, that had the ability to suck me in at times, I was taken aback when suddenly we were, you know, it was like 2 days later. I'm like, well, what just happened for 2 days? Like, people were getting ready to shoot people like a day ago. Did people just not decide to shoot anybody for 2 days? Like, did they go to the grocery store? Like, okay.
They're not in prison. Yeah, wait for the march campaign.
Well, so, I mean, it's talking about history in general. And you can't, I guess you can't change that. And one of the things we mentioned at the top of the show was the fact that there was some controversy over maybe the timeline, not just with what happened, but mainly with LBJ and his interpretation. Clay, did you want to, you know, enlighten us on your opinion of, you know, LBJ's stance on making this happen?
Oh, this is just fun for me, the history guy, but short version is LBJ has never been one of my favorite humans. Like, as a guy, he just is not remembered as the kind of guy you wanted to hang out with on a weekend. As a president, he obviously ran into Vietnam and decided to go with that in a way that cost him a re-election. But as a civil rights figure, he's always been regarded in a way that was, his defining moment was pushing through these civil rights pieces of legislation. So I've never had any personal stakes in the mix. And the movie was very careful, I noticed, to never once use the word Democrat, or to point out that the Democrats controlled both houses of Congress at the time, which is why so much was riding on Johnson's decision, because he could just, with a phone call, make anything go through that he wanted, for the most part. But
then the portrayal, I remember looking at JR in the middle of the movie, and when we left, I was like, I can't believe they came at him like that, because he was known to gratuitously use the N-word, and he was, like many presidents of the era, reluctantly kind of pulled in. So I just didn't have any like real personal allegiance to the guy and had no problem with him being portrayed that way. But then the pushback comes that this is like a huge mistake. And now today, Maureen Dowd and the New York Times and so many other writers are like, I can't believe they got LBJ wrong. This is horrible. And while there are certainly historical interpretations that you could take a look at in Selma, that just really didn't bother me.
Did it just not bother you, or do you really think that it was that different?
Well, I mean, I think there's a Time article that defends LBJ and criticizes his portrayal, and they make the point that Johnson was a seasoned veteran of the legislature. He knew how to play the long game. He understood the timing of policy, and all that is true. There's no way that Martin Luther King Jr. would have been a good politician, because he was an advocate for change. And when something is immoral and unjust, you don't want a timeline. You don't want an excuse. You just want change now.
Yeah.
And so,
especially when you're on the receiving end of the injustice.
Right. So, you know, in that regard, I guess there is truth that, yeah, Johnson was playing a longer game and King wasn't happy with it. But I don't think there was anything terribly historically inaccurate from what I know. Granted, it's limited, and granted, I have friends who love LBJ who I always rib them for picking the wrong president to make their favorite. But, you know, that's my take on it.
Didn't you say too that Johnson was kind of a bully? Like, he used his size and halitosis to intimidate people?
Yeah. They called it the Johnson treatment. I mean, just Google the Johnson treatment.
Careful.
And look at all. This is separate from how he used to skin dip and call aides to come take notes while he was swimming naked around them. I'm not saying anything here that's like not extremely documented.
So what is the Johnson effect?
The Johnson treatment. It's where he would like take someone by the hand or back them against the table, and he would literally lean until they were bending backwards. He was this big 6'4" guy. And he was just totally—he was the all-time close talker. He would get in their space, in their face, and just, you know, he had that presence that he was a big guy. So, you know, like I said, he's just not my favorite guy to think about. But at the same time, he was there at that point in history, and a lot of people would say he wasn't just there. He was helping push forward. He made it a point in the State of the Union that year to talk about driving for ultimate change. And I would certainly not begrudge him what really is his only major success in that area.
Other than Vietnam.
Right, he did great. And now, again, he started many programs that some people love, and I certainly even have benefited from some of the things that he created, his administration created in the 60s, were around in the 90s when I went to college. And I'm aware of all of the historical reality. Work study. Anybody who's ever had a work study job, that comes out of the 60s too. There's a full complicated character. He's a tragic figure for the most part because he thought he was going to go down in history as the greatest president who ever lived. He believed that with all of his heart, and he was going to be a shoo-in for re-election in 1968. But then he told a couple fibs. He went all in on Vietnam, and it cost him his career and ultimately his legacy.
I'm going to have to take a break from the podcast to close down all the pop-ups that just came up when I Googled Johnson treatment.
Weren't you? Yeah. LBJ, congratulations.
Yeah, it's like, full disclaimer, do not actually Google Johnson treatment, Clay.
Just don't hit the images tab.
Yeah, just want to. I was gonna say it sounds a lot like the what we've been referring to as the Clay treatment.
It is crazy, guys. Clay Googled it and he found all the good pictures.
Well, okay, so I think one of the criticisms of LBJ kind of coming off as, I mean, not like the worst guy, but kind of a bad guy. He is a hindrance to the events in the film, or the goal of the events in the film.
Johnson?
Johnson, yeah. because he's still something that, you know, he's still a person that Martin Luther King in the film is kind of at odds with, even though they say they have the same goals. Obviously, they have a different timeline, like Clay was pointing out. But what it does, and like I said, one of the criticisms that I read a lot in reviews or people trying to defend the portrayal of LBJ in this movie were that, you know, in the over time, there it was seen as lots of clergy. There were people of all races, based on their faith or based on personal conviction, who were fighting for civil rights. And the further things got into the 60s, the more there was a narrative that spun that it was kind of black people for themselves. Like, there is no good white person. They're all overcome with racism, and basically black people have to only look to themselves for a helping hand, to make the next step. And in this film, they're really, I wish I could remember exactly how it put it, that the review that I read, but it said basically all the white people who are helping in this are either like portrayed as like basically being in the way, and eventually reluctant, or they're victims. Like we see the preacher who's killed. We see the woman who was killed by some of the Klan members. Like, we don't see people coming alongside them and really, you know, helping blacks make this happen. And I guess the question that I would pull out of that is, one, I guess Clay might again be able to tell us like what that ratio would be of people actually helping. And did you guys feel that kind of black people were on their own based on the way this film, Selma, portrayed the events?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, the reality, did you read the Salon article that came out today? I think it was.
I don't think I did.
They made the point basically that this movie, like you were kind of saying at the beginning, it is told through the lens of the black experience, right? Mm-hmm. So I thought actually that woman who you described, I forget her real name, she was definitely being shown more when they were putting together the care package and whatnot. I was kind of really like, you know, stunned when they put that tagline over her at the end about how she died a few hours later. And, you know, the Salon article and Maureen Dowd or whoever was talking about how the white people are either villains or wimps. And I didn't think that, I thought that there was kind of a balance of a few different things happening. So for me personally, I don't know anything historically about the accuracy of it.
That argument really bothers me, to be honest with you, that, you know, why does a film about the march to, you know, Selma that is, you know, about Martin Luther King Jr. have an obligation to try and make sure they're going to show white people in a, you know, positive light or whatever? That to me is it feels racist.
What was that, JR?
I said, because we had to learn how not to be racist, and that was really hard.
Yeah. I mean, to me, that's just the silliest argument, you know, to say we don't expect that of any other, you know, type of film, you know, that, well, make sure you portray us, you know, we're not all that way. And to me, that it just feels like white guilt to say, you know, make sure that everybody knows that, you know, we're not all that way. It's like, how about we just let, you know, the people whose ancestors were directly affected by this tell their story and just learn from it without having to, you know, make sure that we are portrayed the way we want in a story like that.
Yeah, I agree. And that Salon article really just skewers pretty much in the same direction.
You know, for me, I was struck by a couple of things. One, if this is in fact a film that is showing us Selma through the black lens, which black female director, right? Largely black cast. Like, mm-hmm. We'll grant that. I'm not sure it's entirely bad that it feels like there are no good white people helping, because even King, like, he said that one of the biggest surprises for him in the civil rights movement was how few white clergy joined his movement. Mm-hmm. You know, he was like, I thought for sure once we put out the call for biblical justice, to be done, clergy all over the country would rise up, and a few did, and the film represented them,
mm-hmm.
right? But largely we were silent, and so I don't, if this really is through the black lens, I think a lot of blacks in that era did feel as though they were alone, and so I'm not sure artistically that that's even a bad decision in the film.
Good.
And to John's point, maybe we should just shut our freaking faces and listen instead of rushing to defend ourselves for once.
Well, I guess, yeah. Actually, well, that was one of the next questions I had. I mean, when a film like this comes out, what can we take away from it? And it can be like, what can we take away from it? Because I've had the foresight to, you know, have four white guys talking about a movie about one of the most influential black man that has ever lived. So in my foresight, how should we take that either as white men, or, you know, how should we take that as a society? Like, what impact can this film have 50 years after these events?
You know, I sorry, go ahead.
No, please, John.
You know, I really feel like that. I was really struck by an interview that Chris Rock did last month, where he was talking a lot about racial issues, and he was talking about how oftentimes, you know, people feel like, well, the whole, we're in a post-racial era because, you know, America elected a black president.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris Rock said, you know, that that's not black progress, that's white progress. There were a lot of, you know, black people who were qualified to be president before Barack Obama, but, you know, white people finally got to a point where we were, you know, okay to elect a black president. And it really speaks more to the progress, you know, of white people than it does of black people. So I really feel like anytime films like this come along, it's a reminder of how much work there is still to be done. We have 400 years of history of creating an environment and an economy that was based on mistreating, you know, other people. And suddenly we feel like in 50 years, you know, all that should be taken care of and, you know, just gone away. And I think that's a silly thing to think. So I think we should recognize that these films are here to remind us that the work is not done. There's still injustice. There's still racial injustice. And, you know, the only films that that we really seem to support as a white culture about black people are those that deal with slavery. You know, we were talking about biopics earlier.
Mm-hmm.
The Mandela biopic did not do well at the box office. I think the only black films, if you could call them that, that have done well at the box office are films like 12 Years a Slave that deal with slavery. Roots, you know, was big back in the 1970s. But when we tell the story in the stories of people of color, whether that's Cesar Chavez or Martin Luther King Jr., I think we really do owe it to ourselves to, number one, listen, and number two, try and figure out the practical things that we can take from listening and how to walk that out in our daily lives.
How about that?
Good.
I think, Mikey, the question you raised is essentially the privilege conversation. What are those of us who are advantaged by virtue of our birth, things that we didn't choose, ask for, deserve, earn, but were simply given? What do we do with that? Given that it's not fair, but it's also not anything we had any control over. And I really go back to in the Gospels where Jesus says, to whom much is given, much is expected. Or Spider-Man, with great power comes great responsibility. You know, either one that you would prefer to quote. I think it is, we owe, like John was saying, we owe it to the people who do not have the same privilege we have to listen as hard as we can and learn as much as we can, and as often as we can, use the privilege we have for the advantage of people who don't have it. I think that's what we see in the incarnation, where God abandons heaven and becomes like one of us to rescue and redeem us. And that's that. I don't want to get into white savior stuff at all, because I think that gets really patronizing and paternalistic. I don't think we can necessarily save. I think we can listen. And and we can't change anything until we ourselves are changed. I don't know if you guys have ever encountered any black theology, but it's really provocative and moving. But, you know, there are theologians who basically say that to understand blackness in America is to understand God on the cross, you know. And until we become black the way God is black, we cannot participate in Christ. Which is all for this white boy very disturbing, challenging, threatening. Mm-hmm. You know, it's much easier for me to just say that's silly heresy than it is to seriously listen to someone who has an exceptionally different experience of the divine than I do, specifically because our skin tones are different and we both live in America. You know,
and I would add, as far as for 10 years of teaching, you know, downtown Pittsburgh political science classes and history classes, and having some pretty unique exchanges in a lot of different environments, I love those moments where light bulbs go on. Any teacher does, and for me, it's certainly been educational for this teacher, but also, there are a lot of moments when my students have said, oh, politics does matter. Oh, voting does matter. And if this movie does anything politically, that scene where the President Johnson and Martin Luther King are trying to figure out why they can't take different roads, King walks through the progression. You want to do this, but here's why voting matters.
That was amazing.
It was amazing. And he broke it down. So for one, this generation, black or white, I'm excited that this movie will resonate with them, that somebody paid a price, that somebody sacrificed much, you know, with alongside Dr. King and many other people, maybe some, you know, aunts, uncles, great aunts, grandparents, right? That they can start to see what their family did, either on the bridge or in the South or even in Pittsburgh or New York or whatever part of the country, you know, Los Angeles, where John is, so they can start to recognize that there's a direct link between them and an ancestor in the 20th century who suffered through these kind of injustices, and that it matters. Our political action still matters, even if we feel like the system is rigged and money's out of control and all that. That it I don't know if it glorifies, but it shows the best of what political participation in a democracy can achieve.
Well, I would, if I added anything, which I will, I think the thing that I was hoping people would be able to take from this is what I've been able to take from listening to King's speeches for a couple years now, and that's that all these things that he spearheaded were great and needed, necessary. And it's what we talked about earlier, but the whole reason that he was prompted by this was because of his faith, because he felt people needed more of the gospel, and that was the answer. Because one of my pet peeves are when people quote Martin Luther King, especially out of context, or they just take the second half or the first half of a sentence that sounds good for social change, but they completely take the reasoning for it. And lots of people would say, you know, we just need to treat everyone equal and leave the whole God thing out of it. And you know, Martin Luther King would say, well, you know, we're never going to get there unless we add more, you know, more of the gospel to it. You know, if someone is racist against his neighbor, it's because he needs more of the gospel, not less of the gospel. You know, if you walk past this person in need, it's not because, you know, just don't care. It's because you know, you need to understand their situation. You need more of the gospel. You need to understand what's been done for you. And I love that he would always turn it around and bring it back to that. And it's that passion that like has shaped my worldview and shaped my understanding of how to treat my neighbor, how to, you know, love my enemies and things like that. And because it's been something that, has changed me, you know, I've wanted to almost evangelize some of his teachings and point to where he's been pointing the whole time. And I hope, like I said, you guys obviously saw it a lot more than I did. Not that I didn't see it at all. But I'm hoping that this film, I'm hoping people go see it because I think it's a great film. And two, I hope when they see it, they're like, oh, okay, he's not just, like JR pointed out, he's not just like a social change leader. He's not just a civil rights leader. Like he's a faith leader. He should be up there with, I think, most Christians' pedestal where they put C.S. Lewis. You know, that, you know, Martin Luther King wasn't just a pushover. He wasn't just someone who was motivated because he happened to be black. He was motivated by the gospel and how that changed his life. So, I hope that, like I said, I hope people get that out of it. Do you guys remember the speech that he gives towards the end of the movie at Montgomery? When he finally gets there?
Yeah.
Because we had one question come in from Josh. Just because he's affiliated with a Real World Theology doesn't mean we don't care about his question any less. He asked, what kind of thoughts did you have when you finished hearing that speech? Like, did it stir you? Did it, you know, did you walk out of the theater thinking anything different because of that speech that he gave at the end in Montgomery?
Honestly, that wasn't the stuff that stuck with me.
Hmm.
Not because it was bad.
No, yeah, yeah. But
the scene in the prison, the scene on the bridge,
mm-hmm.
those were much more powerful for me. Even the march itself, when they actually finally cross the bridge and they're walking through the crowds of people waving rebel flags and things like that.
Yeah.
Even those moments were more powerful for me.
Yeah, I also, you know, was moved much more by other parts of the film. I do think the film does well to end with that speech. It's probably worth noting, you know, that they couldn't actually use the direct quotes from mm-hmm. King's speech, King's speech in the film, you know, so a lot of that was actually kind of based on the actual speech King gave. But I was moved by it. I've seen it two or three twice now, and I was moved to tears, you know, both times by the power of the words.
So I was gonna say
they basically had to do what most high schoolers do. They went to the internet and they basically rephrased everything since they couldn't use the words exactly.
I didn't know that. Who owns that? Is it the estate of someone?
Yeah, King's family owns it. King's estate owns it.
And didn't work. The director, Ava DuVernay. What's her name?
Yeah, Ava DuVernay. I talked to her about that actually when I interviewed her. And some of King's children did come to set and visit, and they were able to visit with them. But King's estate is actually a bit of a mess, just because there's several children who kind of have fought and, you know, sued each other, and so it's very difficult to actually get the rights to use King's material because his kids have really not gotten along.
Well, so interesting.
Yeah, following the example, I guess.
Because as I heard that speech, I mean, I remember, again, I was just kind of taking in all the different sites, and I was really. You know, then they start cutting to all of the postscripts, right? And John Lewis, I was really intrigued to watch John Lewis's character through the movie as well. But I remember thinking, like, there were buzzwords in the speech, but I didn't know the Selma speech. So it now that you say that, I guess I can kind of see that it was more like a patchwork. It was mm-hmm. very much a King-style speech, but that's interesting.
Yeah, at the end, you know, in the film, he quotes the song "His Truth Is Marching On," and that actually was how King ended the actual speech. But he actually used the entire song. He quoted the verse and everything. But yeah, they had to reframe a lot of that. But the spirit of what he said is still there, certainly. Yeah.
John, do you know why they started the film where they did with him getting ready to accept his Peace Prize? And was that to give us an intimate look at him and his wife and to meet the character that way? Or did you happen to know anything about why they began there?
You know, I when I talked to Ava, I did ask her a little bit about, you know, certain things that she chose to use to frame to introduce us to King. And one thing she did mention is how important it was to begin the film with showing his humanity, to show him as a human being. Mm-hmm. And so you've got a lot, you know, kind of in that opening scene with his wife, of him concerned about what, you know, the poor would think, him not knowing the proper term for his tie, and just a, you know, a lot of very human moments there that that she begins with. And I really appreciated that, because I think it does start the story in a different tone.
It worked for sure.
Well, I'll have us move kind of towards the wrap up. And in the wrap up, we usually start with things in the film that either didn't quite work for us or just kind of made us roll our eyes. And the tone of this film didn't really give me a lot to roll my eyes at, and I kind of assume that for the most part that feeling's mutual. But is there anything in the film that didn't work for you, or that you thought could have maybe been portrayed a little bit better? And John, we'll start with you.
You know, I didn't really have any major beefs with the film. I think if anything, this is one of those films that I would have appreciated even more screen time, a longer journey than we had. So if anything, for me, it was just, man, I would have loved to have seen things go even deeper, featuring even more scenes, you know, to help us even further get a better picture of who this man was.
Yeah. Okay. Clay?
You know, nothing really jumps out either for me. That's an interesting thought, John. You know, how few times we leave a theater wanting more. So I guess, yeah, some of those gaps would have been filled in a little bit more. Maybe, gosh, I don't know. I think they really touched on all the pertinent facts, you know, well enough. But I walked away thinking a lot. And that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. JR?
Yeah, there were two major things for me. The first was, there were a few moments in the film. The one that stands out to me most notably was just a very minor moment, but it was when Coretta Scott King and another woman were walking somewhere, and they were just having a conversation. And I was like, gosh, that doesn't sound like two people actually talking to each other. It sounds like a really important movie being delivered, you know. And I felt like that a few times in the film, where the dialogue like shifted away from here's how these people really talked to like almost sort of like these have become mythic characters, like, and this has become a mythic story, and so every moment is like the most perfectly executed turn of phrase and the most like grandstanding sort of positioning and all that. Not the whole film by any means, but and again, that one particular scene with Coretta Scott King, and it wasn't the acting, it was the writing. I mean, it was the delivery of the lines was fine, but it was actually saying itself. I was just like, oh, that sounds really wooden. I don't know. So that was honestly relatively a minor thing.
Yeah.
And the other one was, I was just like really disappointed with how little they played up Alexander Hamilton's role in the whole thing. Yeah. I mean, he's such a person in American history.
I don't know if Mikey's audience knows.
For him to not even, I mean, honestly, I don't feel like they even mentioned him or even showed a $10 bill once.
He was barely a footnote.
Yeah. And I just don't, how do you make any American political movie without the most important political person in American history?
In all of American history, really.
This is what I get, John, everywhere I go.
Everywhere.
That's just the Clay's all time favorite historical figure.
One of my favorites.
One of my favorites.
Is Alexander Hamilton.
I did not know that. He's on one of the pieces of money, right?
The 10.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's about my extent of Alexander Hamilton knowledge.
He makes it rain Hamiltons.
I am going to write the Hamilton movie, and we're going to be able to talk about it enough.
Well, okay, so that kind of stinks a little bit, JR, because the Hamilton thing was probably my biggest beef as well.
Yeah. But you've seen a lot of critics talking about it too. It's not mm-hmm. just like
yeah, there'll probably be I've got like 3 or 4 links in the show notes.
So good.
to people who are pretty critical of his non-inclusion.
You talk about underselling a white guy.
Yep.
Come on. Mm-hmm. Where is Hamilton?
Could have been the hero.
I'm starting the hashtag right now. Where's Hamilton?
I mentioned earlier, you know, especially the tone of the film doesn't really lend itself to lots of come on moments. And I really didn't have a problem with most anything that they did. I think the only thing that made me roll my eyes was part of my actual theater experience, because in the first, when they first get to Selma and go up to the courthouse, I'm guessing it's the courthouse, where they're all having their sit down demonstration.
Yeah.
And, the sheriff's like walking through and trying to basically pick on people. The people right beside us, whenever the elderly lady stood up and hit the guy with her purse, they yelled out, "Hell yeah, hit him again." And I was like, "I think you've come to see the wrong movie."
What? You live in North Carolina, but still.
And I was just like, it was like when we went to see, and I think I mentioned this on the Unbroken podcast. We went to see the Unbroken podcast, and the person behind us was saying, "Oh man, I hate those Japanese people. I hope they die." I was like, "I think you again missed the entire point of this film."
You know what? That's really interesting, Mikey, because you talk about how this movie sits in this culture 50 years later.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Malcolm X is definitely a key figure in the film for at least a couple parts in the center. Basically when he's going through his personal transformation before he's assassinated.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a difficult style to adopt for a lot of people back in 1963.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same with Jackie Robinson. We talk about 42. So to sit as a 2014 person in a theater, I couldn't even imagine, you know, what it's like to have that experience all my life. But there might be some kind of a disconnect there, right? Like, that's the one moment where somebody finally steps outside of the passive, the nonviolent resistant line and strikes out, mm-hmm. you know, all throughout the movie. So I could see a lot of modern viewers just having anger build and just wanting someone to lash out.
Yeah, you just want to see that person get that tangible justice.
Yeah, why King's leadership and insistence and his other fellow preachers who led the movement were so important there.
Mm-hmm. Well, so we do like to end, like I said, on a positive note. So there was a lot to like about this film. So, John, like what were some of your favorite moments? I think we probably hit on a couple of them during the podcast, but just to take a second to really highlight them, just what, you know, what did it for you?
Yeah, I think, you know, for me, the scene of King in jail, that scene just really gripped me. The other, you know, scene that absolutely moved me, I've never been a huge fan of Oprah Winfrey's acting,
mm-hmm.
but the scene at the beginning of the film when she is trying to register to vote, that scene just really was moving to me. Maybe the greatest thing that happened with me as a result of seeing this film, though, a day or so later, I was still thinking about the film. And for some reason, I was struck and reminded by one of my favorite little kind of anecdotes or passages in scripture in Genesis 2:19. It's where God's created all the animals and he brings them in front of Adam and lets Adam name the animals. It's always been kind of a really interesting little passage of scripture to me, because having written a book and created things before, I cannot imagine creating this really amazing work and then letting somebody else name it. I mean, I try and think, Clay, all the time it took you, you know, to write your book. Can you imagine then calling up, you know, Mikey or JR and saying, "Hey, I want you to name my book." it just doesn't happen. But I think in that passage, you know, we see God inviting man into the creative process with him. And as a result of seeing this film, I felt like I was invited into the conversation, and I was invited into the creative process of trying to address some of these issues in the whatever little ways I can, and then trying to create, you know, a better world, for lack of a better term. But I felt very much an invitation into the creation that should happen as a result of this film. So that for me was probably the most striking thing that happened as a result of seeing the film. And in a sense, is my favorite moment of the film, even though it's not a direct scene. It was the impact that the film had on me.
Okay, that's totally fair. Who did I do next? Clay?
You know, it might be a little simplistic, but I don't think so. Just the performance of the lead character. Help me out with his name.
David Oyelowo.
Oyelowo. I mean, you know, there are a few times when you come away and it's just the person completely embodied, almost like they were channeling the character, and I just couldn't believe how real King appeared on screen because of his performance. And, you know, there's a physical similarity that goes a long way towards it, but I was just immediately into the story with, you know, a real historical figure. And for me, just his performance is so good that definitely, you know, is not as important as the message and the meaning of the historical events.
That, I mean, I would definitely agree with that. I think that's probably why there's so much, it's outrage, I guess, that he wasn't nominated for the Academy Award for Best Actor. I mean, because he really did sell that role.
It's crazy. And, ridiculous.
And then especially if you go to John's blog and read the interview that he had with David, and he talks about, you know, being British, coming over here, never having a ton of roles as Americans in the first place, and then playing one of the most iconic Americans, you know, in all of American history, and consensus kind of being that he nails it, right?
Yeah.
So, especially when he's in the church and he's like doing the no more speech, his hand motions, and just...
Oh, yeah. That was a really powerful scene. The funeral.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was quite a moment where it felt so real.
Question for you, my white brothers. how did that scene sit with you, watching King use a funeral sermon as a platform to incite
that's why he was there.
Support for his movement? Oh, I know, but how did it sit with you? You were fine with it?
I was.
Well,
yeah, I was okay with it.
Well, I guess the counter question I have is, how do you feel when people use a funeral as basically like an opportunity for like an altar call?
Right, and I hate that.
You hate that? Okay.
In this case, I mean, he starts off by first and foremost talking about the impact of a lost life and a grieving family. And then he is definitely delivering what is a political message. Mm-hmm. But first of all, that's why they're there. That's why he's there. And the family understands that if there's going to be any meaning to come out of such a senseless thing, it's that impacting and lasting change has to be made. So I don't find it, you know, in a way that so many times tragedy is co-opted for someone's agenda or movement. In this case, the death happened exactly because of the injustice which he was calling out from the powerful platform of tragedy.
I felt like he was reassuring the family that the death was not in vain, that you know, he had died for something larger and something bigger, you know, than himself. So I don't know. I found it a bit reassuring that he was, you know, trying to reassure the family.
And they made it a point to put on the screen during the final speech, right, that his grandfather was the
first registered voter in his family. Voter, yeah, you know, I was very bothered by it, as you can tell, And not necessarily I think what that highlighted for me was my privilege that I am able to conduct funerals that don't have such high stakes, you know? And what would I do if I were in that situation? And do I feel okay with, you know, letting grieving take that shape? And I think it highlighted some cultural differences between the way like a lot of Black families grieve and the way white mainstream America deals with death, you know, some stuff like that. So it was interesting. I was very uncomfortable during that scene in a good way. But I was very uncomfortable.
Huh. Well, when I was watching it, I actually thought about the exact question that I asked you, JR, because it's always kind of bothered me when it seems like, especially when losing younger people, they lots of times have pastors who are like their childhood pastors who don't know them for like a decade do their funeral, and it seems like they use the pulpit as like I said, like an altar call when all their college friends come home.
Yep.
And that does really bother me. And so I feel kind of a combination of both. There is an uncomfortableness in me that kind of showed its face when I watched that scene. But at the same time, I think of, you know, what John and Clay were just kind of pointing out, that like the whole purpose of his death had, you know, Martin Luther King was comforting the family, and he was giving the family some, I guess, comfort to know that their son hopefully did not die a meaningless death. And I think that his death, like if, you know, if he had not died and he would have been asked, you know, would you want, you know, do you want your life to count towards this goal? And he would have said, yes, whatever it takes, you know? So I don't think like the dead in this case was being used against what his wishes would have been. Now,
so if the next person requests an altar call at their funeral,
well, before they die, if they're like, yes, you know, have an altar call at my funeral, when I die, that's the last thing I want people to remember about me, then yeah, I guess that's their prerogative. But I mean, it, like, to me, it's different. You know, Martin Luther King was already there. He already was, in a secondhand relationship with this kid who had been killed. You know, like they were all on the same team together. It's not like Al Sharpton or something like heard about this, flew in and started making speeches on the person's behalf that he'd never met, and using that death for his own gain, not for what the death actually was for.
Yeah.
And so that to me is a difference. Still makes me a little uncomfortable, but probably, you know, for all the reasons that you probably pointed out, JR, but you know, I do think it's different. So,
yeah.
Wait, JR, did you?
I did.
You did not? Okay. Give us your.
So this is sort of just like a personal, like where I am when I saw the film, but right now at my church, we're discussing what it sounds like when God speaks to us,
mm-hmm.
and how we can discern the voice of God, given that, you know, the vast majority of us don't have an audible voice talking to us when God speaks to us. And so I thought the various ways that it was shown that King heard from God were incredibly powerful, and that it showed him situated in the midst of this larger context of believers who were all dedicated and committed to the same purpose. And so in a very powerful and decisive moment, when he has to make a very hard decision, and he prays and he hears something seemingly, as the film presented it, like directly from God, I bought it. I was like, yeah, I mean, look, like he surrounded himself with all these people,
mm-hmm.
so that he knew what God's voice sounded like all the time.
Hmm.
And I just, for me, I just, again, I was totally like, yes, that's, you know, calling up the musician. And then again, when they were in the jail and the guy's just quoting scripture to him, because they've immersed themselves so thoroughly in scripture that it becomes the language by which they comfort each other. Like, that was just a beautiful picture of what God's voice sounds like. You know, and it didn't come off as trite. It didn't come off as escapist. It didn't come off as this, like, pie-in-the-sky idealism that a lot of atheists try to paint religion as. It was like, no, like, this actually made them able to fight the good fight by not fighting, you know? So that, I just, that was a, it was beautiful. I thought it was just incredible.
You don't think it would have been more powerful if they would have taken the Ridley Scott approach and personified God as a small child and, you know, Martin Luther King and God maybe could have had fights. And...
alive. It's like, what are you talking about, King?
Well, I would say, oh man, I didn't have a lot of favorite moments. Like that was the moment that did it for me. It was more of like just what I got, like the story in general of Martin Luther King struggling with being this person that he knew he needed to be and other people knew he needed to be, but also trying to hold his marriage together. Trying to
be that person.
What's that?
But he didn't know he could be that person.
Yeah.
He knew he couldn't be what they wanted him to be.
You know, and you know, it was kind of nice. And I think, Clay, you pointed out earlier, you know, we kind of expected more of like a, you know, a hero movie, you know, like he's great, he's awesome, he did everything right, and this is how he changed the world. But it was like, it was tough, he screwed up a lot, and sometimes he doubted he could even go on, but you know, God was able to use him either way, anyway, and that was awesome. I think if I did pick one scene though, I did really like when he called, I don't want to butcher this, John said it earlier, Mahalia Jackson?
Yeah, Mahalia Jackson.
Jackson on the phone just to hear the voice of God, and she just sang to him. I mean, she just got out of bed and like was like, I'm just going to sing. And, you know, just needing to hear that.
And what did she sing?
What's right?
It was like an old song of the faith. That's what she sang. Like, mm-hmm. Again, the song that belongs to the people of God. That is something like for King, it wasn't just like a random song. It like had all of this history and power and testimony behind it. Like amazing. Yeah. Just incredible.
So, so this is that time where we wrap up. So, if you got, John, do you have any final thoughts, any, commendations about this movie or recommendations? I mean, like, or anything we missed, anything that you wanted to hit on?
You know, I just really want to heavily recommend that, you know, people of faith get out and support this film and, you know, that we embrace it in the same way that Christians embraced, you know, The Blind Side or other stories, you know, that have had imperfect people of faith in the lead role. Let's get out and embrace this film because it is a film for our times. It is a film we can learn from, and it can have a much larger impact than we think if we embrace films like this.
Okay. Clay?
I agree.
All right. JR?
I'm a history guy. I'm a history teacher, and
I will tell you what Clay said when we walked out of the theater. First words
what I said.
Were... where was that for the last 10 years of teaching?
That's right. That's right. You know, they put that movie on 2 weeks after I retired from teaching.
Wait, are you actually retired or are you just like on a teaching sabbatical?
Well, we'll see. If someone hires me, I'm going to go back. But I'm on a sabbatical, let's say.
There you go.
But yeah, I appreciate pop culture and it's certainly a fine, high quality film that, you know, pulls people into history and to meaningful political participation.
I'm okay with that. JR?
yeah, again, I'm not sure why someone wouldn't want to go see this film. It's incredible. It's disturbing from the opening scene. You will be uncomfortable. I didn't feel guilty, but I just felt really sad for a lot of the movie. But it pays it off, and it's worth it, and it's real. At the end of the day, if you're bothered by it, good.
Yeah, you should be.
History. Yeah, like, I can't think of a single good reason to not go see this movie. And like John said, you know, quit giving your money to things like Saving Christmas and start giving it to money. Like, if you're a person of faith, give it to things like this, which is like this showcases the kind of followers of Jesus that Christians ought to be.
Mm-hmm.
These are movies that we need. So and beyond that, like, if you haven't read John's pieces that he's done on Selma, you really should. He's gotten to do some pretty awesome interviews, and they give you some even more insight into the film. So go read those before you see the movie, if you need to.
Mm-hmm.
They're really, really worth reading and really cool.
And speaking of John's interviews, John, how can people find what you've been doing on the internet, or how can people get in touch with you if they want to keep following your work?
Yeah, I would love for people to visit my blog. It's at John Bucher, but it's spelled BUCHER.org. That's johnbucher.org. And on Twitter, it is @JohnKBucher, BUCHER.
Clay, how can people follow you?
Clay Morgan, PA. at Clay Morgan, PA on Twitter.
Stands for party animal.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Now that I live in Texas, I'm going to brand myself a Pennsylvanian still. That's the same on Facebook and Twitter. And JR and I share our blog space at NorvalRogers.com. If you want to know how to spell that, just Google Shaggy from Scooby-Doo, and it's his real name.
All right. JR, do you do anything on the internet that people could...
Not really. This is kind of about it.
About it?
No, I do have a Twitter and a Facebook. They're at JR Forasteros. Forasteros. I also, as Clay mentioned, blog at Norval Rogers. At least I did in 2014, and I have a feeling I will at some point this year. And then I also, Clay and I have a podcast we do with Matt McLeod called The Story Men, and then I also have one called Origami Elephants I do with my friend Bryn Lewis, who was part of the Baylor panel that you probably heard if you're a real world listener. So
that's right. If you're a real world listener.
That's right.
You know,
if you're into the deep cuts,
that's right.
Theology.
Deep cut.
Well, if you want to follow me, you can follow me at Physification, or you can follow Real World Theology at Real World Theo on Twitter. If you'd like to know more about Real World Theology, then visit our website, realworldtheology.com. It's realworldtheology.com. There you will find show notes, which will have links to all these fine fellows' internet properties. Every way that you can find these guys, get a hold of these guys, bother these guys, it'll be there in the show notes, so make sure you check it out. Connect with us on Facebook, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher, leave us a review. We love 5-star reviews. The more 5-star reviews we get, the more people find us, the more people enjoy this conversation, and, you know, the more listener questions we get to make people uncomfortable. So, like I said, I just want to thank JR, thank Clay, thank John for taking the time to be here on a Wednesday night. Thanks, guys.
You're welcome, Mikey. It's always a pleasure to be on.
Yeah, thanks, man.
Thank you.
I want to thank you listeners for, just listening to what we had to say for a little over an hour. Taking time to make us part of your week, part of your day, just whatever. It always means a lot to us. And so until next episode...
We would give you 5 stars.
Yes, as listeners, I would give you 5 stars. Well, at least most of you. There's a couple listeners out there that do like listen to the show while they're doing something else, and so they miss some of the good parts. I mean,
how come you didn't talk about this, man?
Yeah, exactly. They're like, well, hey, you should have mentioned that in the podcast. And I was like, we did mention that in the podcast. That must have been why you were cutting onions. So, for you, I give you guys 4.5 stars. But I appreciate you listening anyway. I don't even remember where I was. I feel like I have a parting spiel and JR stopped it, and now I'm sidetracked. Nailed it. Oh yeah. So story is powerful and entertainment's not mindless. Bye.
This podcast is a member of the Crossover Nexus. To find out more or to hear about other podcasts that engage faith and pop culture, please go to www.crossovernexus.com.
I think we should do another one, but each of us take one of the characters from the Wu-Tang Clan and embrace that personality in it.
Not ODB.
Just let it flow.
I want to be the old dirty Baptist. But somebody else could be Methodist man.
Methodist man.
Nice.
Wouldn't that be Clay? And Clay, aren't you Methodist man?
I'm not. Well, I'm writing to the Methodist these days, so I'll take it.
Okay.
Oh wait. So instead of the RZA, I could be the NASA.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
Yeah.
The NZA.
Did y'all just take all the good ones?
Yeah, probably, man. Well, there's Red Man. You could be
Anglican.
Yeah.
Oh, we should do a whole terrible Wu-Tang.
Oh, gosh. I'm getting the shakes.